Okay, so I went to this Episcopal church service and we all engaged in liturgy. And you might have heard of it. It starts off, "Most merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry and we humbly repent." And then it says, "For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us." Part of the conversation that we're having today is attempting to understand what does it mean psychologically to appeal to Jesus Christ while asking God the Father for forgiveness. In my limited understanding, sometimes I think of God as superego, all moral and justice and righteous and maybe even a harsh superego for some people. And so, what does it mean if God is something like superego? What is the Son? What is Jesus Christ that we are appealing to while asking for forgiveness? And there's a few songs I wanted to highlight. One is "How Deep the Father's Love for Us, How Vast Beyond All Measure." In that song, there's the verse, it says, "Behold the man upon the cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished." And then there's a song called "It Was Finished Upon That Cross" by City All Right. No, City All Right. City Alight. City Alight in 2021. "Now the curse, it has been broken. Jesus paid the price for me. Full, the pardon he has offered, great the welcome that I receive. Boldly I approach the Father, clothed in Jesus's righteousness. There is no more guilt to carry. It was finished upon that cross." And then "Rock of Ages" by the Modern Post in 2013. "Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy wounded side, which flowed, be of sin the double cure, save from wrath and make me pure." So, in that song, we get the hint of we are saved from wrath. And so, I just wanted to highlight those lyrics and that theme of we are clothed in the righteousness of Jesus. And so, now I can boldly approach the Father. And so I have with me Dr. Ken James, a Jungian, Dr. Eric Monsager, an Adlerian, and Dr. Don Carveth, more of a classical psychoanalysis type of professor. And I'm hoping that with all of your thoughts and the way that you might perceive and understand this, we can all come to some sort of deeper understanding. So thank you for joining me today, all of you. And Dr. James, you are the first one next to me. So if you wouldn't mind, maybe you could start us off on your thoughts.
I'd be happy to. When you were just talking now, the idea of how did we incur this debt? How did we incur this, what apparently from these liturgical prayers that you, the Confiteor, which is what you were quoting, how did we incur that debt? And we sort of begin in Christianity, I believe, with the notion that we owe something. We are in a state of sin. So I think that's all tied up with what's behind that, what's behind the notion of original sin, which I was raised in a Roman Catholic setting, and studied that theologically. So, where did that debt come from? If you accept the debt, then I suppose the notion of the repayment of that debt or the rectification just follows logically. But where did that debt come from? And especially psychologically, How is that experience?
Yeah. Can I just add that even if one is not a Christian who was raised with the idea of original sin, oh man, I wish I could remember if, who it was, but the quote was something like, yeah, we can never live up to our own standards of morality. And I think that for a lot of people, even non-Christians who were raised in that idea, there might be people who just tend to feel like nothing they do is ever good enough. And I wonder, going back to the idea perhaps of what type of person might psychologically resonate with this idea. Even someone who has never heard of Christianity, and maybe they're hearing about it for the first time, and this is the way that it's presented to them. Yeah, just curious what might psychologically resonate with somebody.
Could I just jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Also, when you were talking, you pointed out the idea of shame for sin. And, Erickson teaches us that shame is sort of the shadow of autonomy. So from the get-go, obviously, we're recapitulating the story of the Garden of Eden here. Once autonomy rears its head, shame follows developmentally. And that's the negotiation of the young child, very young child. So when you say what kind of person, I think the psychological seeds are sown in the typical development of a human person. But that's, yeah.
Don, are you eager
Eric,
to jump
Dr. Monsak.
or?
Yeah.
Okay. So Adler's going to be on the outside of a lot of this, I think. First, the God concept that Adler so appreciated was a construct of the human soul, because he believed the ongoing effort of all human beings, certainly since we became Homo sapien, was an understanding that we are vulnerable and can die, and we want to live. And so to live, we have to do those things that help us perfectly engage in life. And so I introduced this idea of perfection at that point. But it isn't a moral perfection. It is the stuff of life that helps us survive. And it was a hit and miss proposition in our evolutionary or creation story, whichever you're more comfortable with. And ultimately, two issues came forward that made sense, and in which this story from Christianity belongs. That is, there is the ability for us to imagine perfection, but not in the human life beyond that. Perfection as wholeness is how the human being came to understand it. And that wholeness is the community. All the other Homo sapiens or Neanderthals, depending on which group you belong to at the time, I guess. But the idea of finding salvation via the community aimed toward an ideal is how Adler conceptualized much of life here. And he did not assent to sin in any fashion. There was certainly mental illness, although he treated that a little bit more lightly than many. But his concern was in our, just like humanity growing as a species, the individual and family grows and learns and makes mistakes and corrects and tries to get it right. And again, we have imposed on that idea a moral perfection, but it's not wasn't the original concern. It's to keep ourselves alive. And so I would just say that I'll share more about how one can step outside of that. But Adler says that we don't get it right from the beginning. We make mistakes because we have to, for our survival, make decisions about life. Before all the information is in, we can't help but make mistakes. And that's not a sinful mistake. It's just a wrong conclusion. And when we fail to revise our conclusions, we run counter to the community because we think they're not as important as me. And that's because of the errors made in child rearing, rather than developing an empowering love that helps us develop. In each of our stages, Ericksonian or Piagetian or whatever, in such a way that we succeed, we conquer that, and we feel confident in ourselves, and we see that we're joining there are other people who are also doing this, and we really become a piece of part of community. But because of the myriad mistakes that parents and communities can make, we seldom get that empowering love. And so we go awry making mistakes about how I fit in. And then making mistakes about what I substitute for this empowering love, which nowadays we can count in the addictions and things like that. But these aren't sinful. So there's a problem there. I will come back in and explain how Adler quite consciously and with great appreciation, he had a colleague by the name of Ernst Jahn, Jahn. Much like Freud's Pfister. And they wrote a marvelous tract together that I would recommend to all you of us here and anybody who might be listening. It's about 50 pages or so that is one of the best expositions of Adler's theory, but also a very loving presentation of Christianity because John was a Lutheran pastor too. All right, so I'll just pause there for now, and I'll, if I may, come back in and comment about what salvation and the like means, and getting our sins forgiven and those kinds of things, which Adler did not shy away from.
Dr. Carveth, do you have something to
Yeah.
add?
My eyes aren't up to seeing who the names at the bottom of the screen. So, the colleague who just spoke, is that Eric or James?
Eric.
Eric.
Eric is who just spoke.
Yes.
Okay. So I appreciate the Adlerian, you were moving towards narcissism, which I appreciate because I think that's central to the whole subject we're trying to address here. I have a broader concept of narcissism. I don't see it. It can reach pathological proportions, but we are all narcissists. This is the sin of pride, the sin of self-centeredness. So the whole Christianity is about our narcissism, and this is where we sin and where we fail. Where I would disagree, Eric, is I don't believe this problem is due to bad parenting. I believe it's existential. I believe that good parenting can sometimes help, but like one of the things that the psychoanalytic psychodynamic professions have failed to deal with altogether and don't even want to talk about because it challenges our fundamental outlook. Good parents often produce bad kids, and bad parents often produce good kids. We're so heavily invested in the idea that the parenting matters and shapes everything. Well, it doesn't. The human condition is far more complex than that. with temperament. We have all of the influences that come from other sources other than the parents. And there's something in human nature intrinsically in itself that we are excessively self-concerned. Back to the subject of superego, I do not believe God is the superego. The superego is a harsh judge. And if we get many people confuse God with the superego, and the people who have the who really suffer from the problem that we're addressing here, you're asking about this atonement theory, that really appeals to people who have severe superego problems. I consider myself a Christian, but I have to say that Christianity offers a field day for masochists. It offers a field day for people who suffer from severe superego problems and are inclined to beat themselves down. I think the theory we're addressing, this theory of atonement, frankly, I think it's garbage. I think it's pathological. I think it needs to go into the garbage can, and Christianity needs to be freed from it forever. The image of God that it portrays is as a narcissistic old man who will not forgive us for disobedience unless somebody bleeds. Doesn't really matter who bleeds. An innocent son of his can bleed, but someone's got to bleed to placate the old sadist. That is not my concept of God. I have a loving concept of God. So, you know, this theory just is totally out of sync with my concept of God as love. But it's a theory that will attract psychopathology. You know, people who have a sadomasochistic internal organization will be drawn to this theory because they have a need to suffer. They have an unconscious need to punish themselves. So let me leave it there in a moment.
Could I respond?
Yes, please.
Briefly, or I'm happy to wait.
Yeah, go ahead.
So each of us will be speaking in shorthand here, and I don't want, and I will not hold you to having said everything that is needed to be said by the short way that we have to communicate it today.
Yeah.
So I would take that in regard to, parenting. I certainly, being very involved with families and like, do not hold parents accountable for the sins of their children, nor do I hold the children responsible or in debt to their parents for the sins the parents have committed, which is a Hebrew Bible text as well as the New Testament. But parents and family are our first community in most cultures and the like. And so I want to say that there is an impact there. And it was Adler's insights, I think, that went beyond Oedipal kind of first level parental interactions and said the community of siblings and cousins and the like are certainly influential on a person's life, and how all that goes into understanding and always misunderstanding what community is and what community can offer. Pause. And then I would like to add this piece. Don, I appreciated very much having listened to your prior interview with Daniel, the spirit with which you speak and the conviction with which you speak. I'm remembering Edward Said of holy memory, a Palestinian educator and literature, who in regard to Huntington's critique of clash of the civilizations, reminded us that hyperbole, this is why I understand hyperbole is important, and it's a very powerful, I don't disagree with a lot of what you said about this concept of restitution or redemption and the like, but the idea that Jesus died on the cross, as you said yourself in your interviews, and you will expand, I hope, a little bit today, that's where we all end up. Jesus was a sign that hopefully all of us don't end up I mean, we all end up dead, that's for sure, but the way he died was more akin to the way we treat people today that we have no need for. We just throw them away.
Yes.
And he stood powerfully over the years and appealed to the poor throughout the ages of Christendom, anyway. While the landed and the rich made him a king on the top of the domes and the like, and very beautiful icons, I might add. But to the poor, he remained the sufferer, just like I suffered, you know? And so I just introduce that again to remind us that Christendom, too, for all its major faults, also brought a story that I think these and we poor don't have to say we deserve what comes to us, but rather if the other people in our lives cannot connect with what community really means, we will always be left out. That's what happened to Jesus. He brought it on himself. It wasn't, well, depending on your theological outlook, I won't say it's not substitutionary, but according to Jewish law, he deserved to die at the time. He had to appeal to the Roman authority, or they had to appeal to the Roman authorities because they didn't have the death penalty available to them. But Jesus messed up the way the church or the religion was unfolding there, and he
But
called
Eric, it needed to be messed up. It needed to be messed up because it was unconscionable. Jesus came as a conscience and challenged the religion of his time. There's a book written by, I think his name is James Fowler, an evangelical in the US. And the title of his book is Christianity is Not a Religion. And I resonate to that because he sees Christ as challenging the religion of his time. I think he challenges the religion of our time. He's a conscientious objector, and I think he had plenty to object to in temple Judaism of the time, and I think that's why he got crucified. But as a symbol, I don't think he just symbolizes the fact that we, like him, have to die. I think people have crucifying moments throughout their lives. In fact, the stages of the cross that you find in Anglo-Catholic and Roman Catholic churches, you know, and that we walk around at Easter, it's a perfect metaphor for a deep psychoanalytic process. I see patients going through the stations of the cross on my couch when they're really trying to come to grips with what the Jungians call their shadow and the dark side, and they're having to deal with the crucifying contradictions that are built into human existence. Anyway, I've said enough.
Yeah. Can I just jump in? And so I appreciate this, and I too I agree that, like you just now said, Dr. Karveth, that a lot of the times, both of you and Dr. Mansager, you're saying that we, like Christ, have to die and be crucified. But getting back to kind of the psychology of it's not us, it's Jesus. That I think sometimes people drift to with maybe the substitutionary atonement theory. Carl Jung said that it says, have your congregation understood that they must close their ears to the traditional teachings and go through the darkness of their own souls and set aside everything in order to become that which every individual bears in himself as his individual task, and that no one can take this burden from him? We continually pray that this cup may pass from us and not harm us. Even Christ did so, but without success. Yet we use Christ to secure this success for ourselves. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is the psychology of us. Is Christ, is the Son of God, is Christ simply a scapegoat? And the psychological process of that, if let's just say intrapsychically, if Christ is simply a scapegoat, is he simply a, is Christ the symbol, simply a scapegoat, and the superego, in my language, is appeased by that? Or that's what I'm trying to kind of delineate here.
If I could jump in,
Yeah, please do.
from another perspective, I think, the way we imagine psychic dynamics is there's an archetypal ground and everything is, rises up from that. So from that comes the mythic structure. And even if we're talking about the Christian myth or the Judeo-Christian myth or the Abrahamic myth, a problem is, and this may be a problem with the human psyche, is that we deal with it in a fixed state way. And, even in the Hebrew scriptures, if we look at the book of Isaiah, where we see the emergence from, I deserved exile because I intermingled with people who worshiped foreign deities, to Triduo Isaiah, the third part of Isaiah, where we're invited back and there's the theme of redemption. At various times in the apparent history of the Hebrew people, the whole rise of the wisdom tradition came about as a result of rejecting the doctrines that arose from the mythic structure because of their situation in history. And when we talk about Jesus, I can't help but look at all of what the scriptures tell us about Jesus. And we even see this in the structure of the Greek scriptures of the New Testament. There are several interpretations commingled with one outlier with John, and we're trying to get a handle on who this figure was, if this figure even was anything like what the scriptures provide us. And so I see it as a continuing dialogue between the individual psyche and the vast mythic ground that we walk. And I think what we're seeing now in our history is all of the mythic structures that held us for millennia seem to be shifting. I won't say crumbling because that itself is a particular interpretation, but certainly shifting. And so, maybe 100 years ago, talking about the doctrine of atonement would have been the only game in town, but I don't think that we're there anymore. And so this idea of the necessity of suffering, and then I have to feel gratitude because Jesus suffered for me so that I don't have to, which is certainly not the experience of anyone that I know.
That's the wrong message. Yeah.
Right, suffering seems to be part of this experience.
Yeah.
I think that we're really, and what we're seeing, and I'm no scholar of 20th century religion, that's for sure, and certainly not Christianity. But I think what we're seeing are people, attaching themselves unconsciously, of course, to certain aspects of the mythos that are embedded in the archetypal ground, and others are embedding it, are deriving it from another aspect of the archetypal ground. And we're really talking about not the same thing. And we're trying to figure it out using this very finite set of symbols that we have in the scriptures to a certain extent in tradition and in liturgical practice, all of which seek to express the inexpressible. But beyond that is, this shifting ground. And what is the myth that we're called to live? And is my myth the myth that my community tells me it should be if I identify as a Christian or whatever? That's just what I wanted to add because I feel that we're at a time of loosening. And it's very destabilizing if you think in terms of the reification of the mythic structure. But the mythic structure is just a poor rendition, poor rendering of an archetypal dynamic that is, well, unimaginable in the literal sense of that word. So all the images over time are attempts to express this dynamic. And unfortunately, again, because of the nature of limited human life, it's, you know, I mean, it's fairly short. We have to figure it out before it's over. And so we cling to what we can until we're forced, usually by fate or by what Jung would say, the telos or the goal of our suffering, what we're being pulled toward, to relinquish it in favor of entering truly the mystery of every person's human life.
I have a bit of trouble with the emphasis on the mythic structure as a determinant. I mean, I think I'm interested in what is the truth? And some myths are out of sync with the truth, and other myths bring us closer to the truth. But what's important is the truth, not the myth. And I'm interested in Christianity because I think it contains profound existential truth. But there are aspects of Christianity that I think are false, fallacious, that take us away from the truth. The idea that somebody is going to do our suffering for us is an invitation to scapegoating and to magical thinking. I'm not saying we can't help one another. Of course, we can help one another. But I mean, I'm going to die my death. No, as Heidegger says, no one can die my death for me. This is something I have to do. The idea that I have to cope with my guilt. I have to bear it. I have to do my best to not allow it to crush me. I have to do my best to accept forgiveness. But I can't escape my guilt by this magical idea that someone has suffered for me and that magically my guilt is lifted from my shoulders. So I think this aspect that Daniel, the substitutionary theory that Daniel's asked us to talk about, is a false and dangerous line of thinking that I think has done a lot of damage. It breeds wish fulfillment kinds of thinking, wishful thinking. I think we're called to overcome wishful thinking. I think we're called to reality testing and to face harsh realities. I think this aspect of Christianity breeds pathology. And it is attractive to people who suffer from serious superego pathology. And the world is full of scapegoating today. I'm not going to blame that on this theory. But, it's very tempting to scapegoat because you've got this tyrannical superego, which is torturing you. And one way to get out from under it is to join the superego judge and put someone else in its target. And this is happening all over the world these days in a massive way, the scapegoating process. And so it's terrible to find it occupying a place in Christianity.
So I haven't said anything about the superego. I'd like to say something about that, because that's a foreign concept to the Adlerian practitioner. Of course, we come from the hallowed ground of Freud to a degree. I would say, as an Adlerian, there is no superego. There is me. And I use something, a construct I call the superego, to do oh so much mischief. Usually to help me, not anyone else. As I understood or misunderstood, Don, your presentation in your discussion with Daniel earlier, that's always where I'm coming from here, that superego does not represent a harsh God, or it represents my best attempt to divert anyone's attention from my personal goal of perfection, which means me, myself, and I. I'm not attached or I'm not interested at this point in community involvement. It's I'm out for me. And I will strive for that most of my life until I somehow become aware of it. But I know because I live in community that I have to look rather communal and socially interested and the like. And I can put on that air by saying, I'm such a bad person. Oh my goodness, I'm such a sinner. And while they're not looking, I get done what I need to get done. And if I get seen again, oh, you see my sinfulness. Okay. That's how I think the super, and that's too brief, but this is
but the narcissistic dimension of the superego. And we think of narcissism as the grandiose narcissism embodied by Mr. Trump so perfectly, but there's the depressed narcissism. Depressed people are horrible to be around because it's all about how bad they are. It's me, 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 and how bad I am. The other
and what
side,
they need, I mean, as far as our discussion goes, is from the religious point of view, salvation or redemption from that. From Adler's point of view, they need to be freed from their misunderstanding of how they thought they were going to make it in this world.
And I would say freed from the tyrannical superego.
That is, I need to take myself in hand and quit thinking like that and think rather toward the community. That is how I leave such constructs behind and I find myself as a part of the community.
The overcoming of narcissism is what you're talking about, and I agree with you entirely.
In regard to the political situation, I did want to, since the name was raised, it fits this way. And I'm not, look, Adler's whole point was the religious realm and the political realm, both of which he was very familiar with at the time. And it was Trotsky was a personal friend of Adler's. And the wives were best of friends for a long time. Okay. But when he saw the Bolshevik Revolution starting to kill people, it was abhorrent to him. He could not believe that a political system could go that direction because the issue of social interest is we are here to preserve everyone everywhere for all time, or our hearts go out to them.
Yeah, his friend Trotsky was the leader of the Red Army.
That's right. And they broke on that. And Trotsky died the death that he did because he was, because I'm not imputing guilt, but more a violent death because he turned to violence was understandable, perhaps. So that, you know, but the issue here is any political party or community, and they're all over the world, that does not embrace everyone by an Adlerian measure would be a false political messiah. And any religion that does not open itself to everyone and the salvation of all people everywhere for all time is also not following the truth. For Adler, the truth, which he'd have to put air quotes around, because none of us have access to absolute truth that's fallible, sinning, if you will, human beings. But we do know the way, and we grope through that because we know under the aspect of eternity, everyone can find salvation and find their place in the community and in the wholeness of things. And at the end of things, the telos. Because it's only at the end that it all comes together, I guess, or we hope so, you know?
I haven't appreciated until now that Adler is such a critic of narcissism. I guess he doesn't use the word, but this whole emphasis on the need to join the community as opposed to the narcissistic individual pulling away from community, that is that whole thing is a wonderful critique of the fundamental human problem, narcissism.
Don, you would recognize it if you remember the inferiority complex.
Yes.
That, that Jung was attributed to at his death. For that's a little historical quirk. Evidently, when Jung died, one of the obituaries said he's famous for the inferiority complex, which was Adler's. Adler got left out early on and still is. No big problem. But Adler understood narcissism as an inverse of the inferiority feeling, but coming from the same base, and that is a superiority complex, which certainly...
I would say that's a mistake, because it's equally narcissistic to have an inferiority complex, because it's all about me. I'm so inferior. I'm so
exactly.
useless. I'm so dumb. So narcissistic to revel in one's inadequacy.
Well, you point out, though, they are of the same cloth. That's all I'm saying. One manifests, look at me, look at me. And the other one says, look at me suffer. Look at me suffer, or something to that degree. But also a distinction that Ansbacher brought forward about Adler was the finding that narcissists don't have friends. That was Adler's concern. Not that he said me, 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 which is bad enough, but Adler says, but where do other people come into this picture? Because the narcissist will remain isolated until she or he can say, I'm part of something larger than this.
So he develops what Donald Winnicott called the capacity for concern for the other.
Indeed.
Let me jump in here and ask Dr. James. So Dr. Mansager was just talking about how, and Dr. Carveth, how the superego, in air quotes, is a narcissistic thing that it's self-serving, actually, and it keeps us away from the community, and it keeps us doing our own thing until we get caught. And then in terms of Jungian psychology, so if you mentioned before we began that you want to understand God as superego, you want to understand God as the self. And I believe Carl Jung talked about Christ also being a symbol of the self. And if that is the case, then how can this process for what I'm proposing here, the theory of atonement, it seems almost like a part of the self and a part of the self is coming into conflict, and then somehow a resolution takes place. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I think a fundamental principle from the Jungian perspective for understanding psychic wholeness or individuation is a capacity to maintain a tension between opposites, and beyond that, a tension between all of the multipolar directions that any particular ego state can be pulled. And you know, the idea that Jung had some problems with Christianity, and we could talk about that. In particular, that the image of Christ was too much light, which forced the apparent reification of the principle of darkness. I mean, there was Satan in the Hebrew scriptures, but certainly not the way we understand Satan from a Christian perspective. And if you read the Hebrew scriptures or the Old Testament, God just covered all the bases. I mean, I would love, back when I was still teaching, I would have people diagnose Yahweh or diagnose the God in the Abrahamic tradition, because it's really quite wild when you think about it. But the whole idea of holding these opposites rather than allowing them to split apart, and the splitting apart is what gives rise to complexes, a concept, I just have to sell the brand, that Jung actually introduced to depth psychology.
Yeah.
And so the idea of a complex is that there are certain experiences in my little human life that I could not fully metabolize, and it gets placed in the unconscious. The structure of that level of the for Jung, that level of the unconscious, which you call the personal unconscious, derived from something much deeper that was never part of human experience. So everything that we're talking about, the scapegoat, the suffering servant, the good shepherd, all of these are particular complex formations around an archetypal ground that is much more vast. And that would include so-called psychopathological states, which is why Jung, was fully cognizant of psychopathology and realized that in terms of treatment, it may not be helpful to think about that because you have to bring in the opposite in some way. The other thing about what Jung, I think, could bring to this is the idea that I am a good Christian, I am a good anything, I'm a good citizen, I'm a good humanist, I'm a good whatever, good father, good brother, good, is simultaneously creating, because Jung would say that then becomes part of my persona, and that creates the shadow, which is composed of all of that, those elements that are in polar relationship to the elements in the persona. And I don't want to go there. I'm putting it here like my shadow's behind me. So I'm going to experience the shadow out here. And, that's why I have to get rid of this person. I have to put my sins on them, or I have to erase them from the planet, because then everything is wonderful. But it isn't, because the polarity still exists at a very deep level.
Daniel,
Question.
you drew attention to a an apparent contradiction, self and self. It's important to understand that for Jung, self and ego are two different things.
They are very different things. The self is the archetypal core of the ego complex.
Exactly. And the whole point of the individuation process is to move away from ego, persona, and so on. It's almost as if the self is a huge magnet at the core, which is attracting the ego, is pulling on the ego to disintegrate. The individuation process is a kind of surrender of the ego to the
It
thing.
is. It's a relativization of the ego to the self.
And
Right.
I think Jung's self is quite equivalent to Donald Winnicott's true self. And the true self for Winnicott is nothing representational. Any concept you have of yourself is not the true self, because his word for the true self is going on being. He moves self into the field of being rather than the field of knowing. And
Yes.
that's a good way to consider. I think Jung and Winnicott are getting at the same thing. It's the move into authentic being, if you wanted to bring Heidegger into the mix.
If that being were considered universal,
I think,
my experience, my egoic expression of certain aspects of the self, it is at the level of the self that I'm connected to everyone across all
Whoever.
and throughout all time, right?
Quick question. Let's say with this substitutionary theory of atonement, it's likely that the person takes on the idea that I am a wretch, I'm sinful, I'm bad, I'm undeserving, I'm unworthy, and Jesus is sinless and perfect. You were talking about if you take on a certain persona, like I'm a good father, then the shadow side of that is going to be all of the qualities of whatever a bad father is. Is it somehow possible to live in the shadow and project the good persona, like a
Well,
good persona on the.
but good and the idea of good and bad is not, I mean, that's we're already moving very far away from the reality of the self. Because let's take your example of good father. There might be some people who would put under the category of good father at 18, send him out in the world, give him $100 and say, have a nice life. That wouldn't be my I wouldn't, that wouldn't be an attribute of what I would consider to be a good father. So even the idea of living through the shadow, I think what we have to do is understand the utter arbitrariness of any process of selection and intensification that throws something away that's an intimate part of the polarity.
Well, I think there's a problem with that from a Christian point of view.
There is. Yeah.
The distinction between good and bad is intrinsic to Christianity. Freud had this concept of an ego ideal, which is an image of the good person I would like to be. And, you know, people say, what would Jesus do? Jesus is my ideal. I know very well how bad I am and what a sinner I am. And I want to leave my sinfulness behind me and turn and move closer to my ideal, which is who is Jesus. So I don't think we can get away from good and bad. You know, it's
we can't get away.
What I'm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I just that's what I'm asking is how did I was just thinking through. It seems like a psychological process that we might engage in is to see ourselves as good. We don't want to acknowledge the shadow parts of ourselves, so we acknowledge the shadow in other people. But for Christians who see themselves as bad and acknowledge the light and Christ, and Christ is perfect and good, what is that? Is that a reverse process going on, or is that what is that a, taking on the persona of a wretch? And so the shadow side of that is everything that's good. I don't understand. I'm not.
It would be a corruption. It would be a corruption of an otherwise healthy process.
Well, to me, this all emerges out of a collective, not the collective unconscious, but a collective attitude. I said I was raised Roman Catholic. So at seven, as I was preparing for my first confession, at seven, I was taught how to examine my conscience for all of the bad things that I did. I look at that now and I say, wow, that's institutional child abuse.
Yeah, it could be.
I'm sorry.
Good lesson to learn. I mean, we do have to examine our conscience, and we do have to face the badness in us.
But
right?
Why?
But in order to be able to transcend it and cut it out.
You don't cut it out, you grow beyond it.
I grow beyond it. Different language to describe this, but we need to put it behind us. We need to put it away.
But that's
no, it's that, always with us. It's always with us.
No, it's not always with us. The propensity to sin is always with us. But we can, in fact, stop certain sins. We will never stop all sinning, of course. But we can stop certain sins. We can transcend our sinfulness to a degree.
It's and not, that's one way to look at it. One can also grow instead of trying to get the sin or the shadow of something behind us. We can say, there are good things I can do. And not just in the the way that Luther would condemn us for just trying to justify ourselves.
We can persevere
in community with one another. We can turn toward one another and help complete projects that help the community. And
yeah,
that keeps us busy.
Part of the value of community is that the community tells us when we're bad. The community scolds us. It corrects us. That's part of the life in community. That's why community is so essential.
I mean, that's why it's essential.
Wonderful diagnosticians of my sins. And I need
Dr. Monson.
I'm glad that helped you, if she could help you look at your sins.
Yes.
I would say, and I did not say, that you can only do one without the other.
Right.
So, of course, we can, but we can't just go on a negative. We have to encourage to grow in a direction that is toward our potential. And that is the wholeness of the picture, the holistic aspect of what we as a human community are growing toward.
What would Jesus do?
Which is an existential aspect, by the way. I just want to insert that. It's very important, but we don't hold it as an ideal that we can go to, because Gemeinschaft Gefühl itself being a guiding ideal, we know it will never get there. But
that's
the human soul is made to direct itself that way.
Yes.
If I may say a little bit about conflict, because I'm trying to pick up, clearly, not me personally, there's an outlier here, because I so appreciate, I'm in danger of just being quiet listening to you talk about this, because it's a fascinating subject in a mythological kind of language I think you both use. And I guess I do too. But in my mind, it anchors to life in the community. When conflict came forward here, and I can appreciate the polarities that you're speaking of, Ken, but Adler reminded us, or at least those who wanted to listen, this idea that polarities are themselves a fiction. And we're actually talking about variety. And it depends on the person's outlook as to which dark is it. Is light the opposite of dark, or is brightness the opposite of dark, or how do we do that? Certainly, he said, we have those constructs in ourselves. That is what individual psychology was about, trying to determine these things. Now, I bring up this topic and the way Adler tended to look at it, because when he and Jan were going after this issue, Karl Barth's name came forward. A giant in Protestant theology at the time. And I believe he preceded Fowler in talking about Christianity is not
Fowler was religion.
Yeah. And so part of that with some of the other philosophers of the time and theologians talked about the dialectic of Marx through, but in with from Hegel to
Hegel.
Marx.
Yep.
Yeah. And then into Barthian theology. Adler liked that construct, but he said, in his estimation, the antithesis is when there is conflict, not necessarily between opposites, but there is conflict with, let's pause a minute on this. Conflict for Adler was not intrapersonal, because there were no other parts to argue with, except when I make it up in order to excuse myself from something. I have a demon. You'll have to excuse me. Okay. But even that Adler saw as an interpersonal thing. It was the person's desires in the world confronted by the social reality and what he called the common sense, which for him was the repository of all the things we got right since history began and was written down, the common sense. Okay. So when there was a conflict, Adler would say, Barth was talking about an individual with their misunderstanding of how to work in the world, confronted by the world itself and the community. And the, pardon me, thesis, that was thesis, right? I beg your pardon. The antithesis then in the dialectic move, the antithesis is when the person says, I've made a mistake, I've got to find my way out of this. That's the antithesis of thinking I'm correct on all this. Thesis, antithesis. And the synthesis for Adler was when the person's worldview literally felt Anschauung, changed. He or she no longer fit in the world that they feel so antagonistic and that they had to fight all the time. So this was how he understood salvation and what Christianity brought to people as well. Okay, thank you for your patience with me on that. So thinking along the same lines, but Adler does it from a holistic, teleological, which Ken brings up, I know Don, you as well, and a phenomenological as well as a socially interested. I think those are the broadest parameters that all of today's psychological, psychotherapeutic efforts somehow claim. I think that's lovely. We're all of a mind in that, although we might add different embellishments to it. Welcome back, Tim.
Can I
Thank
ask
you.
about the topic of acceptance? So, feeling accepted, feeling like you are good enough, feeling like you are forgiven. For Adlerian, would that be, would it, does acceptance come from community? Is it, you participate in community, they participate in community with you, and through community, you feel like you're accepted. But what about for the person who is ostracized for whatever reason? Are they able to, I feel like some people who feel rejected from the community, they might find acceptance in religion, let's say. But that, again, that psychic process of
Yeah.
feeling accepted, brings that up.
Not Adler so much, but Dreikers, his one of his disciples, termed that belonging, which brings a human element into it. It's not just a one-way acceptance by someone, but a belonging to something that's bigger than both of us. But also just comment that the person who feels accepted in religion but rejected by society, shows a good example of the individuality of acceptance itself. It's based on every individual has a different conception of what that acceptance would be.
Bertrand Russell's reputedly said there are some societies in which the only place a decent person can be is in jail. You don't want acceptance by a sick society.
I guess let me ask you what you think of this. So Eric Fromm in, oh, I can't think of the book right now. The book on love. He wrote a book on love.
The Art of Love.
The Art of Love. Yes, thank you. He was talking about traditionally the masculine father force and the maternal feminine mother force. When you're raising a child, it's the mother who the feminine, you're good the way that you are, you're perfect, we love you, you're loved, you're accepted. And it's the father or the masculine that says, get out, do better. That's all you can do. You need to get out, work, pull your share, always pushing them. And in a lot of ways, I have thought about that's Jesus and God. Jesus says, well, let's start with the Old Testament, let's say, or Yahweh. You're not living up to this, you've sinned. You need to make sacrifices. You need to continually sacrifice because you're always going to mess up and sacrifices need to be made. And then Jesus says, you're accepted the way that you are. You're loved. I'm not going to look around if nobody else condemns you, neither will I. So, in a lot of ways, I think that those are both perhaps the masculine and feminine coming together. But I wanted to see what you thought of that depiction or idea.
I don't like the genderizing of things too much. I mean, nowadays I think it's easier to understand that fathers can mother and mothers can father. So I would want to insist on that. But without attaching the principles to the different genders, there is a distinction between unconditional love, which you were attributing to the maternal and to Jesus, and conditional love, which you were attributing to the Father and to Yahweh. That's a reality, the distinction between unconditional and conditional love. I guess we have to cope with both. But for me, as a Christian and as a Kleinian, I'm a Kleinian Freudian, and Klein sees the cure in some ways a little bit like Kohut. The internalization of a good object. And for Klein, this is more of a pre-Oedipal than an Oedipal task. I mean, through my mother's love, I internalize her love, I internalize her as a loving object. And because she has nurtured and loved me, I feel obliged to give love back. But like I've acknowledged that. Although I don't believe it in a rational sense, I feel that when I die, I'm going into the loving arms of Jesus. And it's okay with me if we substitute my mother, because I attach different names to the good internal object. I call it Jesus. I call it mother. I also call it father, because my father also loved me. And I, not that there were not plenty of problems in my upbringing, but I did manage to internalize a good object. And because I have, I'm not terribly afraid of death. Because I'm going into the arms of the good object. Now, I've also internalized a bad object, but fortunately, the good object is much stronger in me than is the bad object, thanks to many years of psychoanalysis, I think, among other things. So that's how I would approach what you're asking there.
Dr. James, what do you have any thoughts?
I did. And then when Don started talking, I got so interested. Tell me what you want my thoughts about.
Your thoughts on...
Yes, I don't think it is true that the image of the divine in the Old Testament is totally this judgmental, because it's very clear from Genesis, first 11 chapters of Genesis, that, and it really isn't until the Noah story that we start seeing God, a little bit before that, but kind of separating out the people who deserve to be saved from the people who, because it's very clear from the point of view of the patriarchs, they were chosen not based on their merit. Mm-hmm. The scriptures go almost overboard to describe how unworthy, to use a term from, you know, our paradigm, they were to be part of God's chosen, or part of the ones with whom God would cut a covenant.
Right.
So even from the beginning, beginning of the scriptures, the idea that there were certain people who merited certain kind of treatment and others did not, that really wasn't there. And so that when we move, I mean, it gets really big in Christianity for sure. And I'm even uncomfortable with the term Christianity, because there are plenty of people who believe, I imagine, that if I claim to be a Christian and am part of a Christian community, I am one of the good ones. And then I can impose what I believe to be the good on those that I had discerned as being the bad ones. But that's, you know, not all Christians, and certainly not a tradition that I was raised in.
Can I just add something and emphasize something? I'm entirely, you're making a very valuable point. Martin Luther, Yaroslav Pelikan, Terry Eagleton, they all explain that the Christian distinction between law and gospel, Moses and Christ, it's a bit of Christian anti-Semitism to think that. Martin Luther said there is gospel in the Old Testament and there is law in the New Testament. Things don't line up in that way. And that's the point you're making. I entirely agree with that point.
Would you, I think that makes sense. Would you say that for the, let's say for this whole idea of substitutionary atonement, to me, I'm wondering if for a lot of people, that is this story of, they feel that their salvation even is conditional. You can lose your salvation. There are people with this theology who believe you can lose your salvation, and their salvation perhaps is conditional and God's love. But then Jesus comes and he dies for them. And that's the story of unconditional acceptance. Well, as long as you acknowledge that he is your savior, that's the one condition. But for in this type of thinking, does that match up with the masculine and the feminine, if we want to use that language just for now? And
let me, if I may.
Yeah.
Masculine and feminine are also a variety, I would say. They're false dichotomies. Okay. And I want to come, Fred Adler, I don't mean to be argumentative and say this is it. I really don't. But there is this other way of looking at things that, you know, dichotomies are very attractive because they're clear. That's one of the tricks of it and why they become fictional, and we can impose them on people as who is dark and who is light. And isn't dark a bad thing after all? Just ask the political schema of the day. I wanted to share this idea of the growth of salvation history somehow fit into or came to mind, Daniel, as you're asking your questions, from the Hebrew scriptures to the Christian scriptures. Adler, looking back on it, said, this was growth. This is also how the concept of God itself came forward as a perfection directing thing. Now, to the degree that the substitutionary theory stands today, I would say we are in danger of people not taking responsibility for themselves. That's what happens there. And I can't put it directly. Ken and I had it in our discussion, but Don, I heard it in yours, that mental health has to do with accepting one's personal responsibility and getting on with life and joining in larger. Anyway, it was echoing to me of the idea of Gemeinschaftsgefühl, the feeling of community and belonging and the like. And it seems to me this is what Jesus had discovered anew in his own way in a barren land and time of history that it wasn't very apparent. But who before him had? Buddha had. Lao Tzu had, I guess, to some degree. Moses certainly had that. And without argument, and I would defend a position, the soldier of Islam also represented that. And the Holy Quran is full of this idea of caring for one another and doing your duty. I think this cannot be called the law of Christ, and people who do those things cannot be called Christian. I appreciate, Ken, the hesitancy we use to call ourselves Christians at times, but this spirit, Hegel would call it, Jesus called it the spirit, or Paul did anyway, this has been part of humanity since we became sapient and we're able to think about ourselves. And I wanted to reintroduce that, not that it would go anyplace, but this growth is what psychology is part of the legacy of. And holistic psychologies and psychotherapies, and humanistic especially, is how we are called to fulfill the same mandate. Not to take on the sins of another, but to forgive those who are sinning around us, because we've all got to do that so we can get about living together and not calling names and calling them poisons to our society and things like that. And to the degree
I have to push back against this excessive emphasis on community. When the community is evil, our job is to defy and rebel against it, as Jesus rebelled against the church of his time.
Jesus, so you quoted Jesus. I thought you were quoting Adler. He said we cannot be satisfied with any historical manifestation of community.
Absolutely.
That's why the Gemeinschaftsgefühl is under the aspect of eternity. We will never reach it, but we must always formulate toward it.
Right.
With this idea that everyone, everywhere, for all time, even the sinners, even the ugly ones, even the people that are today fomenting hatred, we have to somehow include them.
Yeah.
Not perhaps as they are, but perhaps in a vigorous debate that we hope people will listen to.
The ability to stand against community. You see, I love whistleblowers. I myself am not a team player. I will throw the team under the bus if the team is unethical. And I think that's a part of being a Christian, being prepared to throw the team under the bus because the team has lost its way.
Don, how do you determine what is unethical personally?
Or fundamental what do you... principle of love, that which is unloving. Our fundamental responsibility, well, I'm an enthusiast of Immanuel Levinas.
Yes.
Ethics is first philosophy. And in the face of the other, I encounter my infinite obligation to care for the other. And so unethical
That's
behavior.
That's not a contradiction then. It's not a contradiction to face the other and know that I owe him a debt.
I don't find that a contradiction. I find that an existential fact that I if I open myself, many people won't look into the face of the other. They look away from the face of the other. They don't see the other. But to the extent that you see the other, I think you experience an infinite obligation to care. Unethical behavior is a failure of caring.
I agree. This is, I think, the feeling of community, which, I mean, it's all one word, of course, a long one, but it contains this idea that the other is also me. And in the community, the reason there is no dichotomy between self-interest and other interest is because I am part of the other. And when I benefit others, I am taken up in that goodness. And with some attention to ourselves and what we actually need, if we care well for ourselves, we are benefiting our
with ecological thinking, for sure.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could throw something in here to kind of bring in another point. While you were talking about, you know, Judaism and Christianity, in many respects, Christianity is just another messianic sect that got out of hand. And one of the shadow elements in Christianity is power and domination. Because the church militant, ever since Constantine decided Christianity was going to be good for what his plans were, the militant aspect of Christianity, which perhaps is also reflected in Islam, but not necessarily, at least post-exilically, within the Jewish community. That's something that I think...
Brilliant essay by called The Power, Jay Haley. Jay Haley, the psychodynamic theorist Jay Haley, wrote a wonderful essay called The Power Tactics of Jesus Christ.
Huh, interesting. But, you know, what about that in terms of, you know, if there is a power shadow to Christianity, how does that square with any of it? Because then, you know, a power complex can be very seductive.
That's Christian sinning.
Which is?
Being distracted into power tactics. That's Christian.
Isn't that, at least since Constantine, isn't that baked into Christianity?
Hasn't it been since the beginning of time, Ken?
Yes.
Power movement over other people is the history of humanity. And learning the Gemeinschaftsgefühl to counter that and to supersede it is what we're all religions and political schemas are about.
Yes.
But I guess It's been that way since time, but Dr. James, are you saying that how are we going to get away from, like you just said, Dr. Monsager, that's what religions are trying to do. But Dr. James, are you saying that that's baked into Christianity?
I was saying in a particular way. So when we start talking about Christianity as somehow a religion of love, as opposed to, I don't think that Judaism is a religion of love. I think it's there, but there's other concerns. But you have the church something, the church militant and the church triumphant. What was the first one? The church penitent? I can't remember. But anyway, you can tell I was raised Catholic. There's threes, there's sevens, we discard. But the church militant is the one that I'm talking about. And clearly power is, just look at human history. But that a religious tradition took that over.
Yes, I can
It
see
was,
Jesus looking at the church and saying, "Oh my God, look what
yeah.
they've made in my name."
Right. And as I say, it was it, the history of Christianity is so short compared to the history of Judaism, where there was such an opportunity to play the power game and then be beaten and then be exiled and then figure out why are we still suffering? That was generations ago. So I'm not saying that that wasn't part of it, but especially now, I mean the imagery. The apocalyptic imagery, the eschatological sort of addiction that seems to be part of what is passing for Christianity, at least here in the United States, is frightening to me. I mean, we want to talk psychology, but I don't think we can separate that from, it's kind of in the water we drink.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly also in the way we treat one another and what we're fed on the social feeds and in the political discussions, if we could call them that. We oughtn't call them that, I guess. But power, Adler said, is the primary striving of the individual to survive. Not power over, however, just the what he called the aggression drive originally is a striving to stay alive. And he sees that striving, that's how he termed it later on, is what we face individually, but always collectively as well. And I guess I just want to say it feels very right to be here talking about this at this time, just days before the election. And what others who might listen to us can grasp from religion, from the psychologies themselves, from humanism, that we mustn't give up. The people in this room right now have to be speaking for the generations, that will listen. And ours are small little voices here. I get that. But we can certainly join our voices to that and call out Don in the way you were saying. I think that's a prophetic voice that Christianity, Islam, and Judaism share, rightly, that they call out what is wrong in the world, which is anti-human or anti-other,
Yes.
And Ken, to your point, how we can call this stuff Christianity or anything is remarkable to me.
And Eric Fromm, of course, argues that Marxism is an extension of the prophetic community as well. And like everything else, Marxism went seriously awry. Christianity has gone seriously awry in many ways. But of course,
Isn't
every
it?
human goes awry.
Of course. But it's a progression. We have to, I mean, we can believe it that way anyway, that's the sublation we were talking about in the dialectic. It comes and it goes. We're due for a pretty heavy sublation just now. And we're going to get tucked in and turned over. But the Nazi movement didn't last. Something happened. And I think this time too, it won't last. There is something that's coming up in that regard.
Well, I admire your optimism, and I wish I could sustain mine. But 10 years ago, I wrote a review of that book, The Third Extinction. I'm not optimistic
May I
about
share?
the future of humanity on this planet.
Yeah. Heinz Ansbacher, who did Adler's translations in the early versions, said, I don't know if he was quoting Adler, I don't think so, but it was certainly Adlerian in spirit. He said, we must be optimists
I
because
agree.
the pessimists are right.
That's good. That's really good. That's a good reason to be an optimist. Well,
Oh
plus
my
it's
God.
so it's an ethical position. I mean, I think
Yeah.
we are ethically required to be optimistic, and therefore I feel guilty when I express some of my pessimism. That's not what I should be doing.
But if it's accurate and we can use it and you can bring us into dialogue, Don, it is exactly what you should be saying. And remaining open like this. And Daniel, I think that is to your great benefit and my our appreciation. Yeah.
Yeah,
You know.
Jung said, we don't become conscious by imagining figures of light, but we become conscious by making the darkness conscious. And there's too much, if we just look at psychology, I think there's too much in some of the psychological paradigms that seem to be very popular now of this, everyone is wonderful and everyone is special and everyone is capable.
Positive psychology.
And I would love, I really would love to be able to embrace that. But it feels like spiritual sh shortcutting. We're all wonderful, so we don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
And that drains us of the initiative to take responsibility for ourselves and our shortcomings. That's the problem with pampering. It's always been the problem with pampering. It's pampering that brought, in my estimation, brings forth narcissism of all sorts. It was done for me. It must be done for me now. I got it then. I must have deserved it. I deserve it now. Don't you dare stop, or I'll just
What does that
wait.
mean collectively? I don't mean to. What does it mean collectively that we're now in an era of trigger warnings? I'm no longer teaching. But I stopped teaching in 2008. But if I were still to, how in the world
Exactly.
can you teach literature? How can you teach psychology? How can you teach if everything has to have a trigger warning?
I got out 10 years after you did, and things were starting to get pretty bad when I took retirement finally. And boy, it's a relief to be out of there.
I see it
It's
as
an
rather
over.
constraining too. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just going to share the trigger warning is an overcompensation for the natural compensation that should have been we need to be sensitive to one another. And we were so insensitive to each other for such a long time when the generation of pampered World War II babies had their babies, then we were ready to seek vengeance and say, you can't do that anymore. And it's a shame because it oughtn't go on anymore, but we don't have to be pampering each other in the meantime. We can say we're in this together. Can I do something for you if this upsets you, And or can I
Maybe that's
voice
one too
here?
far.
Yeah.
Can I jump in real quick? Because Dr. James, what you were saying about, I wish I could remember your exact words, but basically just a second ago, you were saying, how did we get here to where everything you do is fine and perfect? And no, like you need to. So that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier. So before, maybe around 10 years ago, I was more in the evangelical camp. And but I saw that every church service I went to, or even if I was visiting other churches, it was very much the only thing that was talked about is you are loved, you are accepted, you the here's Jesus and come as you are, and there's no change that needs to happen. And in my mind, I would think there's not enough God here. Like all Jesus, not enough God. And for those people who felt all condemned and they felt like they were terrible, I would say not enough Jesus. Like so that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier when I was asking Does that, yeah, are we, you get what I'm trying to
Well, the
say here?
tension between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. I've always been a bit of a Good Friday Christian, more than an Easter Sunday Christian, but we got to have both, right? There has to be a striving towards a balance. Here's dialectical thinking. And
Agree.
Is I want to be mindful of time. Maybe take the next 10 minutes to maybe any closing thoughts or remarks from each of you and
Daniel.
Sorry, Daniel. It feels like we've covered the field.
Well, I did want to share something that didn't fit in earlier on,
Okay.
that I very briefly, because I've tried to bring Adler's theory itself in, which I know is at odds with things, but in my study of spirituality and a broader context, I ran across a Catholic nun by the name of Sandra Schneider. I don't know.
Yes.
She worked in spirituality itself, and she suggested this as a definition. Now, of course, there are innumerable definitions of spirituality, but for the psychologist working with this, it appealed to me deeply. I'll first read it in its length, and then I'd like to point out something. Spirituality might be described as the experience of consciously striving to integrate one's life in terms not of isolation and self-absorption, but of self-transcendence toward the ultimate value one perceives. It's a remarkable statement, full of wisdom, I think. And I just wanted to point out that the striving, I've tried to say this is what the human movement is since becoming Homo sapien. That integration we've all talked about from different points of view. Ken, you and I had a discussion about this integration from the Jungian point of view, and Adler saying the holistic, unified lifestyle of sorts. I know they're not the same, but this integration touches both of us. In terms of self-transcendence, now I say in the spirit of what we're small s, we're talking about today, any stepping beyond myself is self-transcendent. Whether it goes vertically to another belief and being is secondary and important, but secondary to the fact that we have all self-transcended in our discussions today toward our ultimate value. And for this is a tricky one. Ultimate value being, well, whatever it is to us. But from an Adlerian point of view, this is the fictional final goal, which is never a healthy thing. And so the admonition is to get in touch with that fictional goal, which would be a false god, if I could mix my metaphors here, and say, we have the job of creating an ultimate value that embraces everyone, everywhere, for all time. That's why I thought it was so helpful that Adler too could participate in such a discussion that otherwise he's left out of. Well,
Yeah, thank you.
thank you guys very much. I've really enjoyed your company and the discussion.
Yeah, me too.
Me too.